Well, welcome to this third lecture on C.G. Jung and the Red Book. I stated that this third lecture would be about C.G. Jung and religious tradition. However, as I considered the lecture over the last couple of weeks, I understood that it actually had another name. It's a name given to me, I suppose, by my own soul 16 years ago. It's called The Prophet's Bride. It's a title that has a subtitle, and for 16 years I've tried to figure out exactly how to put that subtitle into words. One of my favorites was The Prophet's Bride, Sex, Religion, and Vision. Now that has a little punch. Then there was Vision in the Western Imaginative Tradition. Or it was called The Prophet's Bride, The Bridal Chamber Mystery in Western History. Or The Prophet's Bride, Tradition of the Sacred Wedding. Or The Mystery Conjunctionis in Western Tradition, The Mystery of the Bridal Chamber. But as I considered again over the last week, I understood that the best subtitle to that lecture name, The Prophet's Bride, is this: The Prophet's Bride, C.G. Jung, and the Red Book. Now, over the next couple of weeks, in this lecture and in the one to come, I'm going to try to summarize, several hundred pages in that imaginal book to you. We have a lot to cover. The lecture is going to take about 90 minutes, and I understand that is pushing you a bit in your attention spans, but there you have it. Here we go. As I suggested in our last meeting, Jung was an explorer of the human soul. The Red Book is the journal of that initial, intense, and transformative exploration. Jung's psychological writings and the terminology subsequently defined therein might be called the map, the outline forms of the terrain Jung encountered. The map that Jung bequeathed us in his subsequent psychological writings, and indeed the experience that he underwent itself, the experience documented in the Red Book, did have a goal. The purpose of Jung's map and his many psychological essays was to direct us at a goal, or at least help us understand that the journey led to a result, and that this result was sometimes achieved. If you ask anyone who has passing familiarity with Jungian psychology, what is the goal of the so-called Jungian psychoanalytic process, they are likely to quickly give a one-word answer: individuation. Individuation. Jung said it simply thus: the goal of psychological development is self-realization, individuation. The editor of the Red Book, Dr. Sonu Shamdasamy, states, "Liber Novus presents the prototype of Jung's conception of the individuation process." The prototype, the first model, the first model of Jung's conception of the individuation process. It, the Red Book, is the record of Jung's process of individuation. But what is individuation? What does that word mean? People will throw this out to you if you ask them, what's the goal of Jungian psychological development? But very few of them understand the answer resting behind that word. What did Jung point at with this word? Well, he pointed at his own journey, in part. Individuation might be described as a profound healing, a becoming whole. Whole is the root meaning of heal. The two are related in the history of our language. And this need for a healing, for a becoming whole, assumes that there is some form of woundedness, some incompleteness in us. So then, what's that wound? What makes us not whole? What is it that requires a healing? What is the missing element? Jung says it is our mythopoetic imagination. Myth-making, mythopoetic, myth-making imagination. Our investigation, exploration, and integration of the psychic fact behind consciousness, behind exterior, sensual life. We have, says Dr. Jung, lost our soul as modern people, and the contact with the voice of the depths which the soul brings. In the view of Jung, without this half, we are only half human and haunted. Here again, let me read from Dr. Shyam Dasani's editorial comments. Jung held that the significance of his fantasies, and when I use that word fantasies, here you might also substitute the word vision, the word imagination, because in our current time, fantasy has been devalued in its meanings. Jung used this word in reference to a very ancient and long tradition of the fantastic, the imaginal. Starting again, Jung held the significance of his fantasies was due to the fact that they stemmed from the mythopoetic imagination, which was missing in the present rational age. The task of individuation lay in establishing a dialogue with the fantasy figures, or contents of the collective unconscious, and integrating them into consciousness. Hence, recovering the value of the mythopoetic imagination, which had been lost to our modern age, and thereby reconciling the spirit of this times, the spirit of this times with the spirit of the depths. The contents and depths of that imagination are, in Jung's view, a natural fact. For Jung, the fantasy, the vision, the imaginal, is an interior dimension reaching into untold mystery. Imagination is the eye of our journey, the royal highway that opens into the psychic realm. Fantasy, imagination, vision are human functions, natural possessions of human nature that lead to an autonomous inner realm, which is also a natural fact, a natural possession, a natural element of human nature. This realm is never possessed or entirely comprehended by our daylight consciousness. It is not an object we now or ever will possess. Better stated, it possesses us. The word individuation is frequently used in Jungian psychology, speaking of a goal. But in fact, individuation, as Jung meant and understood that word, is a rare, a difficult, and sacrificial road to be walked. It is a difficult path into a very difficult journey. And Jung said this because he had walked that path. The Red Book is the prototype, the first fact of his understanding of this term, individuation. Jung describes the process, describes the word here better. This is from his great essay on the Trinity. And I quote, "Because individuation is an heroic and often tragic task, the most difficult of all, it involves suffering, a passion of the ego. The ordinary empirical man we once were is burdened with the fate of losing himself in a greater dimension and being robbed of his fancied freedom of will. As a result of the integration of conscious and unconscious, his ego enters the divine realm." End quote. Consider that statement. The empirical man, you, empirical woman, empirical human, loses himself, herself, in a greater dimension, entering the divine realm. Not becoming lost. That would be the descent into psychosis, which was, of course, a danger of this process that Jung well recognized. Not becoming lost. On the contrary, individuation requires the empirical fact of our known self, ego, losing its sovereignty, its sense of ultimate freedom as master of the house. It was a sacrifice. The ego was hung on a cross of mystery in this process. It was submitted to a greater fact, the fact of the soul, and the mystery that directed. Individuation was a potential result of the process of meeting this unknown other, the forgotten half of ourselves. That journey led through a forgotten dimension of experience, conscious awareness, an exploration of an inner imaginal realm. In that journey, the ego confronted a timeless reality, a spirit of the depths. Dear Edward Ettinger, one of my favorite of all Jungian psychologists, psychiatrists, said, "If you wonder why a supposedly intelligent, educated man like C.G. Jung could have such strange ideas, well, you might come to understand the psyche. These are strange ideas. They aren't, however, theories. The man had these ideas because of something that happened to him, because of a place he went, because of things he saw, and because the things those things did to him, taught him." His individuation was a transformational journey. But back to Jung's biography, what he did, the experience that produced Liber Novus. Remember, Jung was attempting to meet the imaginal realm, not in dream, but in consciousness, through a technique of visualization that granted the image independent reality. He called the technique in later years active imagination. By active conscious effort, entering into the imaginal, letting go of consciousness, letting the psyche speak, just as it tries to speak to us from behind the veil of dream. Or, pathologically, from within the chaos of psychosis. He called this process by another name as well. He called it the transcendent function. In 1916, when Jung was in the midst of this process, in the first years of writing the Red Book, he wrote a paper called The Transcendent Function. And it could very well serve as a necessary introduction to the book itself. The paper, however, was never published. It was found in his personal papers in the mid-1950s by students at the C.G. Jung Institute. And they wished to publish it in its original form. Jung felt it was a very provisional first effort at describing his journey, but allowed it to be published with an introduction. And in that introduction, he warned of three things. This seeking for a direct imaginal encounter with the psyche, which I define with the word vision, but it could be called fantasy or imagination, entering into it, accepting it as real, dialoguing with it, allowing it to be the other half, the forgotten half of you. Well, there are three dangers. The first danger was at the beginning of the process, it would devolve simply into free association, something similar to what Freud had done. One idea or word associates with another. It stays very much in our conscious realm, or the reflection of our conscious realm. The second danger was that we would go there and, well, actually have some very interesting visionary material occur. But we would treat it pretty much as we would a night at the movies. It would have no ethical power. It would have no transformative effect. We would treat it as an aesthetic amusement, and nothing would happen to us. The third danger is that we would meet it, and we would fall into it. We would identify with it. We would lose our perspective and become truly psychotic, enter into psychosis, lose contact with reality. Three real dangers. What Jung suggested was that we needed to find the fourth way. But he warns that fourth way, his way, is a very narrow and difficult route. Few walk it. Nonetheless, walking this path is the road to individuation, the journey of coming to terms with the unconscious, of becoming whole. And this union, if it begins to happen, it comes with a natural affect of eros, of love, of relationship, relationship of opposites, of two things closely associated but severed, finding each other again. In his later alchemical writings, Jung adopted ancient words for it. It is a complexio positorum, a union of opposites, a holy wedding and its consummation, a mysterium conjunctionis, a mystery of the conjunction. The one who emerged from this alembic of mixing hot and cold, sulfur and salt, king and queen, sense and nonsense, was transformed. That was the process of individuation. Becoming whole, healed, wedding together the two facts of human nature. I hesitate to say this, but Jung said it quite publicly and quite frequently. This was a process by which we became not Christians, but Christs. Not Buddhists, but Bodhisattvas. not vessels of ego, but truly a self. Self with a capital S. Jung said, and I quote, "The drama of the archetypal life of Christ describes in symbolic images the events of the conscious life, as well as in the life that transcends consciousness. Of a man who has been transformed by his higher destiny. Of this higher destiny, the self, the product of the individuation journey," Jung further states, quote, "it might as well be called God in us. The beginnings of our whole psychic life seem to be inextricably rooted to this point, and our highest and deepest purposes seem to be striving toward it." The miracle of that conjunction transformed not only a woman and a man, but potentially humanity. What emerged from this process of unification was a stone, an elixir of life, an elixir of healing. Those who touched that stone and partook of that elixir were changed, transformed, made wholly human, individuated. In all this, there was, of course, an abiding religious or spiritual or mystical tenor. And Jung said that the process almost invariably activated these intense religious images, symbols, and responsive feelings. Jung went on this journey without a map. And in the land he entered, he found the images of ancient gods. And it seemed they had a desire for rebirth. That rebirth could only take place through the fact of a human life. A human life and the vision of a human life was the womb of rebirth. As he says in the Red Book, to give birth to the ancients in a new time is creation. He comments in Memories, Dreams, Reflections near the end of his life, "It is, of course, ironical that I, a psychiatrist, should at almost every step of my experience have run into the same psychic material, which is the stuff of psychosis and is found in the insane. This is the fund of unconscious images, which fatally confuse the mental patient. But it is also the matrix of a mythopoetic imagination which has vanished from our rational age. Though such imagination is present everywhere, it is both tabooed and dreaded, so that it even appears to be a risky experiment or a questionable adventure to entrust oneself to the uncertain path that leads into the depths of the unconscious. It is considered the path of error, of equivocation, and misunderstanding. It has existed from the beginnings of philosophical alchemy and Gnosticism down to Nietzsche's Zarathustra. Unpopular, ambiguous, and dangerous. It is a voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world. A voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world." In the introductory pages of the Red Book, Jung explains further. And I quote, "If you remain within the arbitrary and artificially created boundaries, you will walk as between two high walls. You do not see the immensity of the world. But if you break down the walls that confine your view, then the ancient sleeper awakens in you. There, in the whirl of chaos, dwells eternal wonder. Your world begins to become wonderful. Man belongs not only to an ordered world, he also belongs in the wonder world of his soul. Two poles. Your soul is in great need because drought weighs on its world. If you look outside yourselves, you see far off forests and mountains, and above them your vision climbs to the realms of the stars. And if you look within yourselves, you will see, on the other hand, the nearby, as far off and infinite, since the world of the inner is as infinite as the world of the outer. Just as you become a part of the manifold essence of the world through your bodies, so you become a part of the manifold essence of the inner world through your soul. The inner world is truly infinite, in no way poorer than the outer one. Man lives in two worlds. End quote. The inner world is truly infinite, in no way poorer than the outer one. Man lives in two worlds. The process of individuation is a voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world, the other unknown world, the world beyond the ends of the earth, the Ultima Thule I spoke about last week, the end of the world known to the spirit of this times. And we are the crucible in which those two poles, the known and the unknown, the inner and the outer, are wed. In this series of lectures, I cannot give you a complete summary of the Red Book. It's my attempt, basically, to give you something of a map, an orienting approach to some of the things going on in the book. For those of you who are looking for help in reading the book, for a companion in that reading, I highly suggest to you the lectures being given in Los Angeles right now by my dear friend, Dr. Stefan Heller. Dr. Heller is going through the Red Book chapter by chapter and reading. His series of lectures are going to complete at about 13 or 14 lectures, and he's very close to the end right now. These are an excellent companion, found excellent by some of the wisest of Jungian scholars who I know, who have listened to them, to your reading of the Red Book. And these lectures are available online. If you simply look for Dr. Heller or lectures on the Red Book on Google, you'll find them. You'll also find a link on my webpage, gnosis.org. I can't give you that sort of intense reading in these short lectures. What I want to try to give you instead is that overview, that introductory material that might orient your approach to the text. Jung himself actually gave us a map, a general outline of his experience. In 1925, he gave a series of lectures to a small group of about 12 or maybe 15 people who he was working with and knew quite well personally in Zurich. As I mentioned in our last lecture, several of these people knew quite a bit about the process that Jung had been through and the writing of the Red Book. A very few of them had seen some or even one or two of them, all of the material that came to be in the Red Book. And they wanted to know about his process, about what had happened, which, as I said last week, was a thing that Jung had not talked about publicly then, in 1925, just less than a decade after the events, or subsequently for much of his life, until he wrote Memories, Dreams, Reflections, or at least dictated parts of memories, dreams, reflections in his conversations with his secretary, Aniela Yaffe, at the end of his life. Both in the 1925 lecture series and in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Jung actually does give us, we find now, with the Red Book in hand, in our possession, we find that he gives four markers of his journey. They're the only four signposts of the journey that he publicly revealed. And I think it wise to consider them as just that, important markers. They are the four that Jung himself noted, to which he pointed. The first marker that he mentions in 25, the 25 seminar, and also in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, we talked about last week in our lectures. We talked about how he initiated the process of opening vision, of opening the active imagination. Remember, I told you that he took the fantasy of digging, until he entered into the fact of that process, knowing that fantasy would lead to fantasy. And then it did, on December 12th of 1913. In the very early stages of this journey, he found a doorway into a cave, a dwarf, a stone, a river. That was the beginning of his visionary exploration. He said that when that particular vision came, that imagination, he felt as if he had dropped several thousand feet into the earth. But he had found the way. Something had begun to happen. Two nights later, I believe it was December 14th of 1913, it happened again. But this time, he says, and here I quote from Memories, Dreams, Reflections, "In order to seize hold of the fantasies, I frequently imagined a steep descent. I even made several attempts to get to the very bottom. The first time, as it were, I reached a depth of about 1,000 feet. The next time, I found myself at the edge of a cosmic abyss. It was like a voyage to the moon or a descent into empty space." If one speaks about the first marker that he gives, and he tells in some detail about this process of coming to that first vision, one that happened on the 12th of December of 1913, of the cave. When he talks about this, he gives this as basically the signpost of the beginning of vision. This second one, the second vision, he had gone through the door. The first was the doorway. In this one, he had gone through. He had entered a cosmic abyss of reality, the other pole of the earth, shall we say. And again, I just have to emphasize to you, as I did at length in the lecture last week, it was the point of my lecture last week, that these were not idle literary exercises. The man was there. That was the point. He entered into the psychic reality, and when he met these figures, they were as real as he was. They were as real to him as you are sitting in those chairs in this audience to me tonight, as I am to you standing here speaking. This one I have to read, and this is from the Red Book. Marker 2, the vision of Elijah and Salome. "On the night when I considered the essence of God, I became aware of an image. I lay in a dark depth. An old man stood before me. He looked like one of the old prophets. A black serpent lay at his feet. Some distance away, I saw a house with columns. A beautiful maiden stepped out of the door. She walked uncertainly and I see that she is blind. The old man waves to me, and I follow him to the house at the foot of the sheer rock wall. The serpent creeps behind us. Darkness reigns inside the house. We are in a high hall with a glittering wall. A bright stone, the color of water, lies in the background. As I look into its reflection, the images of Eve, the tree, and the serpent appear to me. After this, I catch sight of Odysseus and his voyage on the high seas. Suddenly, a door opens on the right, onto a garden full of bright sunshine. We step outside, and the old man says to me, "Do you know where you are?" Jung, "I am a stranger here, and everything seems strange to me, anxious as in a dream. Who are you?" The old man responds, "I am Elijah, and this is my daughter, Salome." Jung, "The daughter of Herod, the bloodthirsty woman?" Now here, to those of you who don't have much familiarity with Bible stories, you'll remember that John the Baptist was he who announced the coming of the Lord Christ. He was murdered by Herod. His daughter was Salome. Salome had danced for the head of John the prophet. Okay. "The daughter of Herod, the bloodthirsty woman," says Jung. "Elijah, why do you judge so? You see that she is blind. She is my daughter, the daughter of the prophet." Jung, "What miracle has united you?" Elijah, "It is no miracle. It was so from the beginning. My wisdom and my daughter are one." Jung, "I am shocked. I am incapable of grasping it." Elijah, "Consider this. Her blindness and my sight have made us companions through eternity." Jung, "Forgive my astonishment. Am I truly in the underworld?" And then Salome, the young woman, edges up to him, and she speaks. "Do you love me?" That's what I like, a direct woman. They're a little scary, though. So Salome says, "Do you love me?" Jung, "I love you? What gives you the right to such thoughts?" That's not a nice thing to say to a lady, but "I love you. Who gives you the right to such thoughts?" Salome, "I love you. Leave me be. I dread you, you beast." Salome, "You do me wrong. Elijah is my father, and he knows the deepest mysteries. The walls of his house are made of precious stone. His wells hold healing water, and his eyes see the things of the future. And what wouldn't you give for a single look into the infinite unfolding of what is to come? Are these not worth a sin for you?" Jung, "Your temptation is devilish. I long to be back in the upper world. It is dreadful here. How oppressive and heavy is the air." Elijah, "What do you want? The choice is yours." Jung, "But I do not belong to the dead. I live in the light of the world. Why should I torment myself here with Salome? Do I not have enough of my own life to deal with?" Elijah, "You heard what Salome said." Jung, I cannot believe that you, the prophet, can recognize her as a daughter and a companion. Is she not engendered from Heinous' seed? Was she not vain greed and criminal lust? Elijah. But she loved the holy man. Jung. And shamefully shed his precious blood. Elijah. She loved the prophet who announced the new God to the world. She loved him. Do you understand that? For she is my daughter. Jung. Do you think that because she is your daughter, she loved the prophet in John, the father? Elijah. By her love shall you know her. Jung. But how did she love him? Do you call that love? Elijah. What else was it? Jung. I'm horrified. Who wouldn't be horrified? Elijah. Are you cowardly? Consider this. I and my daughter have been one since eternity. Jung. You pose dreadful riddles. How could it be that this unholy woman and you, the prophet of your God, could be one? Elijah. Why are you amazed? But you see it. We are together. Jung. What my eyes see is exactly what I cannot grasp. You, Elijah, who are a prophet, the mouth of God, and she, a bloodthirsty whore. You are the symbols of the most extreme contradiction. Elijah responds, we are real. We are not symbols. We are real. We are not symbols. The conversation here ends, and Jung proceeds with his affect, his sense of the moment. He writes, I see how the black serpent writhes up the tree and hides in the branches. Everything becomes gloomy and doubtful. Elijah rises. I follow, and we go silently back through the hall. Doubt tears me apart. It is all so unreal, and yet a part of my longing remains behind. Will I come again? Salome loves me. Do I love her? I hear wild music, a tambourine, a sultry moonlit night, the bloody staring head of the Holy One. Fear seizes me. I rush out. I am surrounded by the dark night. It is pitch black all around me. Who murdered the hero? Is this why Salome loves me? Do I love her? And did I therefore murder the hero? Is she one with the prophet, one with John, but also one with me? Woe, was she the hand of God? I do not love her. I fear her. Then the spirit of the depths spoke to me and said, therein you acknowledge her divine power. And Jung's last words, must I love Salome? This is the doorway to which Jung has passed. This is the beginning of the imaginative process of the Red Book. He enters the door, he meets a prophet and a daughter who declares her love and requests his. Elijah came in the role of prophet, but with him there came Salome, a bride. And she had dwelt with Elijah, so it was said, from the beginning. My wisdom and my daughter are one, declared Elijah. Salome, do you love me? Jung, how could I love you? How should I love you? Salome, you will love me. Jung, I love you. Who gives you the right to such thoughts? Salome, I love you. You know, I've said Jung undertook this journey of discovery without a map. But as the journey progressed, as he recognized the terrain and the hallmark figures who dwelt there, he began to find in the outer world, in the daylight world, forgotten scraps of maps of this terrain in real, extant, ancient documents, in sacred writings, in religion's symbolic and mythic foundations. Parts of old maps that seemed to accord very well with the experience, with the journey, the experience of the journey he was taking. The writing on these old maps took several dialects. They shifted voice. They needed to be translated into an understandable modern tongue. But the vocabulary, you must understand, the vocabulary of Jung's interpretation was supplied from his own imaginative intercourse with the soul and the imaginal realm into which she initiated him. He read history through his own vision. He found in history a figure very much like Salome. And again, you must understand that this experience influences a great amount of the essay of Jung in his later life. You will find him pointing back to these words, hidden, never revealed to you or to anyone else until this last year when the Red Book was published. Never revealed to anyone else, generally, shall we say. But he pointed back continually. Salome had an aspect of the image of a figure known as Sophia in the ancient religious traditions of the West. Sophia. Her name alone means wisdom. The ancient writing, the wisdom of Solomon, which Jung knew well, states Sophia was with the Lord from the beginning, as Salome had been with Elijah for all eternity. She was this divine lady of wisdom who made men prophets. Let me read you from the wisdom of Solomon. For she is the breath of the power of God, in a pure effluence from the glory of the Almighty. Therefore can nothing defiled enter into her, for she is the brightness of the everlasting light, the unspotted mirror of the power of God and the image of his goodness. And being but one, she can do all things. Remaining in herself, she makes all things new. In all ages, entering into holy souls and making them friends of gods and prophets. Who makes men prophets? Sophia. She enters into the friends of God. She maketh them the friends of God and prophets. For God loveth him that dwelleth with wisdom, Sophia. For she is more beautiful than the sun, and above all the order of the stars, being compared with the light, she is found before it. He that loveth her loveth life, and they that seek her early shall be filled with joy. He that holdeth her fast shall inherit glory, and whoever she entereth, the Lord will bless. They that serve her shall minister to the Holy One, and them that love her, the Lord doth love. So there ends the reading from the Wisdom of Solomon. Elijah and Salome. Signpost 2. The entry. The gatekeepers of the entry into Jung's process of the imagination. Elijah was the prophetic voice of wisdom. Salome, Sophia, was the experience that granted wisdom. They were together from eternity. One image that comes to me is an old Christian Gnostic symbol of three letters, the word phos and the word zoe. Phos means light. Zoe means life. These three-letter words both have the same central letter, omega. In ancient times, one finds this made as a cross, phos, transliterated into English P-O-S, and zoe, transliterated Z-O-A. A cross of light, a cross of life, a crossing of two. Elijah has the image of the light, the knowing of wisdom. But to be a knower of wisdom, one has to know. Sophia, Salome, here, Jung's soul here, is the thing that he is knowing. She is the one who is making of him through his experience of her. Wise. Wise in her way. Wise in the way of the ancient prophetic voice. To know the road, one must be a wayfaring man. As a result of that journey, one is made a knower of the road. These are two different things. Just as a bridegroom and a bride are different and become two things joined in one sacred union. They are a hieroskanos, a sacred wedding, a mystery of conjunction, the mysterium conjunctionis. The story of the Red Book proceeds, and here I can't give you that in detail. At this point, I would hope that you have a copy and are reading a bit. After passing this gatekeeper experience, Jung meets many other figures. Principal among them, Ammonius, a noble hermit, an anchorite, living alone in the Syrian desert, reading again and again the Gospel of John. He meets the Red One, the blind man, the librarian, the fat doctor, the cook, the one-eyed, the hanged man. In one of the most beautiful sections of the Red Book, he meets Izdubar, the god from the East who Jung poisons with his own modern mentality, who dies and whom Jung has to regenerate. The incantations that Jung recites, as he kneels in prayer before the egg from which Izdubar will again emerge, are one of the most beautiful linguistically and also beautiful artistically sections of the Red Book. These many events pass, and you should understand that they pass in rapid sequence over a series of nights in December and January, December 1913 and January of 1914. Jung has really fallen down the rabbit hole. He realizes that there's something in his experience which might best be termed magic. He doesn't really know what that word means. He's experienced something that indicates it. He has been given a gift at this point from the darkness by his soul. It is a staff enwrapped with a serpent. She tells him it is the gift of magic. Now that staff, in symbolic imagery, is found associated with, well, the physician, the caduceus, the staff of Asclepius, the doctor. It's also associated in Hermetic tradition, and again, by that route, with medicine, in the staff of Hermes, enwrapped with two serpents. It's magical. And he feels that he needs the help of a magician. About this time in January, Jung had a very impressive dream, and you'll read about it in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. You probably have if you've read the book. He has a dream of an old man flying through the air. The man has angelic kingfisher wings, blue iridescent wings. He has horns. He bears in his hand a ring of four keys, holding one of those keys in his hand. Apparently, this dream occurred about this time when Jung went looking for the old man. After the dream, he painted it to solidify it in his memory. It was so impressive. After the dream, Jung entered into a vision, the vision of the magician. After a long search, I found the small house in the country fronted by a large bed of tulips. And here I'm reading from the Red Book. This is where Philemon, the magician, lives with his wife, Baucis. Philemon is one of those magicians who has not yet managed to banish old age, but who lives it with dignity. And his wife can only do the same. Their interests seem to have become narrow, even childish. They water their bed of tulips and tell each other about the flowers that have newly appeared. And their days fade into a pale, wavering chiaroscuro, lit up by the past, only slightly frightened of the darkness of what is to come. Jung continues, why is Philemon a magician? Does he conjure up immortality for himself, a life beyond? He was probably only a magician by profession, and now he appears to be a pensioned magician who has retired from service. His desirous and creative drive have expired, and he now enjoys his well-earned rest out of sheer incapacity, like every old man who can do nothing else than plant tulips and water his garden. There goes old Philemon in the garden, bent with a watering can in his shaking hand. Baucis stands at the kitchen window and looks at him calmly. I stand at the garden gate. They have not noticed the stranger. Philemon, old magician, how are you? I call out to him. He does not hear me. Seems to be stone deaf. I follow him and I take his arm. He turns and greets me awkwardly and trembling. He has a white beard and thin white hair and a wrinkled face. And there appears to be something about his face. His eyes are gray and old, and something in them is strange. One would like to say, alive. I am well, stranger, he says. But what are you doing here? Philemon and Baucis. Philemon and Baucis. Those names occur in mythic history. They come from a story written by Ovid, one of the three canonical, three great Latin poets, along with Horace and Virgil, in his book Metamorphoses. He tells the story of an old man and woman. They're keepers of an inn, Philemon and Baucis. The gods come to stay at the inn. The gods, Zeus and Hermes, Hermes, messenger of the gods. His wife goes to sacrifice their last goose. They are poor. They have very little, but guests have come. The guests will be honored with food. She goes to sacrifice the goose to feed these guests, not knowing who they were. When Zeus and Hermes see what she is doing, that she is sacrificing for them the last of their earthly possessions, they reveal themselves. And Zeus and Hermes honor Philemon and Baucis, this poor old couple. They save them from an impending doom, a flood, and they make of their home, their humble cottage, a temple. Philemon and Baucis serve in this temple, serve the gods. And after their death, they become two ancient entwined trees. That story was a mythic theme in the art and literature of the 15th and 16th centuries. The scene of Philemon and Baucis at the table with Zeus and Hermes is painted by Rubens. It's painted by Rembrandt, or the Rembrandt painting exists actually in the National Museum in Washington, D.C. It became a theme to an opera written by Haydn in the late 1700s, and in Goethe's great story, Faust, in part two, this figure, Philemon and Baucis, again appear. In Faust's story, well, the ending is somewhat different. Philemon and Baucis, the little inn that they keep, is at the edge of a land that Faust is reclaiming for the greater development of his world. He wants them evicted, moved away, so that he can have their land for his modern, progressive actions. And so Mephistopheles murders them. Faust murders the innkeepers who gave honor, refuge, place of welcome to the gods. Throughout his life, Jung felt great remorse for that sin of Faust, that act of Faust, to the point that when he built his own tower in Bollingen a few years after completing the Red Book journey, he dedicated it with these words, "Shrine of Philemon, repentance of Faust." Shrine of Philemon, repentance of Faust. I wanted to read you a great deal more about the story of Philemon, but it is one of the longer sections of the Red Book, and I realized that I could only begin to read it over the course of perhaps 45 minutes or more, so I will not tell you much more. In this early meeting with Philemon, at the first approach of Jung to Philemon, he calls him an old retired magician on a pension, shaking, trembling with age. He doesn't seem to know much. But then, after he greets Philemon, they begin to have a discussion. Jung keeps trying to draw him out, and Philemon is trying basically to push him away. "Why do you visit me? What do you think I have to offer you?" And Jung persists, keeps asking him questions, and begins to get a sense that Philemon does know something, that thing he saw in his eyes on their meeting was life, a greater life. I suggest to you that you read this section of Philemon, and most particularly Jung's ode to Philemon, Jung's song to Philemon that occurs after this first encounter. On a reflection and consideration that progressed through the next 40 years of his life, Jung came to understand Philemon in progressively deepening, amplifying ways. I said this is signpost 3 that Jung gave us of his journey. The first, the cave, the beginning of vision. The second, the doorkeepers, the real entry into the visionary world, Elijah and Salome. And then the magician, Philemon. As Jung says, Philemon and other figures of my fantasy brought home to me the crucial insight that there are things in the psyche which I do not produce, but which produce themselves and have their own life. Philemon represented a force which was not myself. Philemon represented superior insight. He was a mysterious figure to me. At times he seemed to me quite real, as if he were a living personality. I went walking up and down the garden with him, and to me he was what the Indians call a guru. Did you hear what he said? I went walking up and down the garden with Philemon. You know, he did. Philemon was to him like a living person. Many years later, I think actually it was about 15 years after this event, he was visited by an Indian scholar who confessed to him that his own teacher had been a Vedic scholar who had been dead for centuries, that he had had a spirit as a guru. When the man said this to Jung, he was astonished. He realized that his own experience of having a spirit as a guru was not altogether unknown in the world. The fourth marker of this journey, the fourth marker that Jung talked about, was the coming of the seven sermons to the dead. The entry into the vision, the meeting of the gatekeepers of the vision, meeting Philemon, understanding who Philemon was, finding Philemon as a guide, a guru. And then, finally, and this is the last part of the Red Book, this is the conclusion of the draft that the Red Book contains. Philemon, speaking through Jung, seven sermons. In these last pages of the Red Book, Jung reveals a mystery. His understanding of Philemon has gone from feeble, old, retired magician to prophetic, magical figure, to guru, to image of great insight. When Jung sees Philemon as he stands to present the seven sermons to the dead, which I highly advise you to read, they were the only part of the Red Book material that Jung ever published during his lifetime. I said four markers. The seven sermons, what I would call the summary revelation of the Red Book, was the only part of this material that Jung published. He said it offered an image of all that he had to say in coming years in his psychology. After this revelation came to him, these words were spoken by Philemon. He wrote them down. He had them published privately. And throughout his life, he gave copies to others. The only way to get a copy of this was from the hand of Jung. And he did share it. It was secret. Few saw it. It was not open to public disclosure. When Philemon finally arrives to present the seven sermons at the end of the Red Book. He comes vested in the white robes of a priest. And he speaks. On the last page of the Red Book, Jung goes into his garden and he sees Philemon standing underneath a tree in the shade under the bright noonday sun. He begins to approach Philemon to speak with him. And then he sees that there is a second figure. And that second figure who has come to his garden is Christ. Philemon addresses Christ. Christ addresses Philemon, not knowing who he is. He says, "Who are you? Are you Simon Magus?" Philemon responds, "I have been known by that name. I am known by the name of Philemon, and my wife is known as Baucis now. Once upon a time, we were known as Simon Magus and Helena." Ancient Gnostic prophet, founder, one would say, of the mythical, mystical tradition of Christianity. Who he was, his importance, I'll let you consider. Philemon reveals that he too has a bride. He, Simon Magus of ancient times, had found his bride, Helena, in a house of prostitutes. He had taken her from that place because he had recognized that she was Sophia. She was the bearer of Lady Wisdom. Simon had wed himself. Simon the prophet, Simon the magician, had taken a bride. And he honored that bride as the wisdom of God, though the world might call her a whore. But he knew who she was. He knew her. She was the experience of Simon's wisdom. Elijah and Salome at the door, a prophet and a bride. Philemon and Baucis, husband and wife, keepers of the inn where the gods visited, where the gods were given welcome. Simon and Helena, prophet and his bride, in the garden. You see, this journey of Jung, I said it was an experience. I talked to you about a process of individuation, of meeting the other pole, the other half, what Jung called a voyage of discovery. I told you that thing discovered, when it was discovered, well, one met it with eros, with love, with emotion, with powers of union. The unknown was indeed ourselves. It was a wedding. Jung, as prophet, if we use that term, had a bride. And what was the bride? His soul. His experience. The experience of that unknown. The Prophet's Bride, the Red Book. Consider it. I've used that word prophet many times. So was Jung a prophet? In 1922, on January 5th of 1922, Jung addressed his soul This is one of the last conversations he has with her. And just to give you a quick time frame here, the visions open up in December of 1913. They continue intensely across the winter months of 1913-1914. Towards the spring and summer of 1914, they end. And then the Great War, World War I, erupts in August of 1914. When the war erupted, Jung understood that his visions that he had been having had a precognitive element. He had been seeing the coming of that great destruction, amongst the many other things he saw in his visions. That fact of the eruption of the war gave him permission, he says, to actually write down what he had seen into a draft manuscript. Write down the story of his journey, his encounter with the imaginal, with his soul. He felt that it had a message, not just for himself, but for the world. Then, from the time of the outbreak of the Great War in 1914 through the summer of 1915, the visions pretty much end. During this period, he's writing out his first draft of the Red Book. He's beginning work on the manuscript. The final work that we see in the Red Book is first penned, beginning in 1915. And then, as he begins work on the draft, work on the Red Book, the visions open up again in 1915 and 1916. It's in January of 1916, in early February of 1916, that he really begins to recognize who Philemon was. It's this point where Philemon gives the revelation of the seven sermons, the end of all the material in the Red Book. But it doesn't end there. In 1917, 1918, 1919, as recorded in Black Books 6 and 7, Jung's final diaries of this most dangerous, most difficult experiment, there is more material. Now we're in 1922, near the very end of this entire eruption. And he can't sleep. It's January 5th, and he writes, or should I say, he addresses his soul. Jung speaks. I feel that I must speak to you. Why do you not let me sleep, as I am tired? I feel that the disturbance comes from you. What induces you to keep me awake? His soul responds, now is no time to sleep, but you should be awake and prepare important matters in nocturnal work. The great work begins. Jung, responding to these words, what great work? The soul. The work that should now be undertaken. It is a great and difficult work. There is no time to sleep. If you find no time during the day to remain in the work. Jung, but I had no idea that something of this kind was taking place. The soul. But you could have told by the fact that I have been disturbing your sleep for a long time. You have been too unconscious for a long time. Now you must go to a higher level of consciousness. Jung, I'm ready. What is it? Speak. His soul. You should listen. To no longer be a Christian is easy. But what next? For more is yet to come. Everything is waiting for you. And you? You remain silent and have nothing to say. But you should speak. Why have you received the revelation? Why have you received the revelation? You should not hide it. You concern yourself with form. Is the form important when it is a matter of revelation? Jung, speaking again to his soul. "But you are not thinking I should publish what I have written," speaking of Liber Novus. "That would be a misfortune, and who would understand it?" Soul: "No, listen. You should not break up a marriage, namely the marriage with me. You should not break up a marriage, namely the marriage with me," his bride. "No person should supplant me. I want to rule alone." Jung: "So you want to rule? From whence do you take the right for such a presumption?" His soul: "This right comes to me because I serve you and your calling. I could just as well say that you came first, but above all, your calling comes first." Jung: "But what is my calling?" His soul: "The new religion and its proclamation." Jung: "Oh God, how should I do this?" His soul: "Do not be of such little faith. No one knows it as you do. There is no one who could say it as well as you could." Jung: "But who knows if you are not lying?" Jung's soul: "Ask yourself if I am lying. I speak the truth." End of conversation. Recorded in Jung's black book on the night it occurred. You have the revelation. Did Jung form a new religion? Well, the answer is no. And yes, depending on how you look at it. We'll talk more about that specific in our next encounter. I want to finish with just one more comment, commentary on what I've talked about here. One of the most interesting students Jung had during this period was a young woman by the name of Carrie Fink. Carrie was one of the first early woman doctors. She graduated from Johns Hopkins Medical School, I think, in the teens sometime, at a time when there weren't too many women becoming doctors at Johns Hopkins. She married, and then after 3 years, about age 27, 28, divorced, and went to Zurich to work with Jung. I believe she arrived in Zurich around 1922. At this time, she went by her married name, Carrie De Angulo. Subsequently, a few years later, she married another Jungian disciple, shall we say, by the name of Baines. And the name you may know her by in literature is Carrie F. Baines. Okay, that biographical data may be of no particular interest, but she was an incredible woman. And she developed a very close relationship with Dr. Jung. In her analysis, she became a good friend. And she is perhaps the one person in this period, this is 1923, 1924, 1925, to whom Jung really revealed the story of his journey. Jung gave Carrie Baines his complete manuscript of the Red Book to read, because he said it was necessary for her to fully understand the foundation of what had happened. And they had intense discussions. Jung at this time was considering this issue. His soul had told him, you have the revelation. Reveal it. Speak it. And he was wondering whether he should try to publish the Red Book. And he was having intense conversations with Carrie Baines on just this subject. And this is the amazing thing, is after their sessions, after their conversations, Carrie went home and wrote them down as if they were a letter. She would write, and you said this, and then I said, and then you responded to me this, as if it were a letter recounting their conversation written back to Jung. Of course, these were private journal entries. These were pretty much unknown. This primary documentation of this critical period in Jung's life was pretty much unknown until Dr. Sonu Shamdasani, editor of the Red Book, and believe me, an incredible scholar, tracked them down. He found Carrie Baines' daughter, and through his interactions with her, gained access to this very private material. So, on January 26th of 1924, Carrie comes home from a conversation with Jung, and she writes in her journal, and I quote, "You told me then something more of your own attitude toward the Red Book. You said some of it hurt your sense of the fitness of things, but that you had started on the principle of voluntariness, that is, making no corrections, so you had stuck to that." And here let me interject a note. What he means by this is that the Red Book really contains fairly precise transcriptions from his diaries, from the contemporaneous event of his recording the vision. He made hardly any change in putting it in the Red Book, even if it embarrassed him, even if he found it strange. And believe me, some of it is quite strange. He maintained this policy of honesty. This is what happened. Here it is. Okay? And then she continues. "There were various figures speaking. Elijah, Father Philemon, etc. But all appeared to be phases of what you thought ought to be called the Master. You were sure that this latter was the same who inspired Buddha, Mani, Christ, Mohammed, all those who may be said to have communed with God." Did you hear that correctly? So, Carrie's recording what they've discussed, and Jung has told her this. Elijah and Philemon were two forms, or phases, images, figurative expressions of an experience which Jung says ought to be properly called the Master. Jung states that he was, quote, "sure that this latter was the same who inspired Buddha, Mani," the prophet Mani, an important figure of the 3rd century and 4th century, "who inspired Buddha, Mani, Christ, and Muhammad." Okay, from a statement of this intensity, made in privacy to a very close friend and student, one of Jung's closest trusted friends in this period, you will begin to understand the depth and immensity of Jung's experience, of Jung's journey, his process of individuation. Words like these were not publicly known, but they were known to a few. Known now, they might influence a secular person of this time to declare the man mad. But before doing so, I would call to your recollection that the historical figures of Buddha, of Jesus of Nazareth, of Mani, of Mohammed, were all human beings who did have, by testimony of history, extraordinary experiences. They were real people around whom the flood of 2,000 years of history breaks, eddies, channels, and flows. Had they had some similar experience of the Master? Well, Jung suggested he thought they had. So, by this fact, had Jung become a prophet? Well, let me read you the rest of what Carrie Baines recorded of that conversation. She continues, speaking of this again, "All appeared to be phases of what you thought ought to be called the Master. You were sure that this latter was the same who inspired Buddha, Mani, Christ, Muhammad, all those who may be said to have communed with God." And then she continues, "But the others had identified with him, the Master. You absolutely refused to. It could not be for you, you said. You had to remain the psychologist, the person who understood the process." Let me read that again. "But the others had identified with him. You absolutely refused to. It could not be for you. You said you had to remain the psychologist, the person who understood the process. I then said that the process, that the thing to be done was to enable the world to understand the process. You said it was something like that. Perhaps it cannot yet be done. As you talked, I grew more and more aware of the immeasurability of the ideas which are filling you. You said they had the shadow of eternity upon them, and I could feel the truth of it." End quote. This is one of the keys, you see, to Jung. Yes, he had this experience. He came to meet figures such as Elijah. His master, his guru, was a figure by the name of Philemon, a shapeshifter, an old retired magician, a prophet, and his bride. But the critical issue here, you see, is he kept 2 feet on the ground. Jung was a doctor. Yes, in that tradition of doctor, there had been a magical staff. And in fact, well, doctors to this very day are expected to be both magicians and prophets. I've had many people come to me expecting me to raise the dead. And, you know, for the very dead, it's not so possible, but for the almost possibly not completely dead, sometimes it works. And for all of history, this was actually what was called a magical act. People come to me looking for prophecy. The easiest one is, "Doc, am I going to die?" That one, I can give a certain definite answer to. Yes. Sometimes I can add in prophecy, but not probably today and not probably from this malady. Okay. He was a doctor. A healer of the soul. Now, throughout history, people have had experiences. He said others that had experiences like this. And really, all of his essay, all of Jung's writings from this point on are an effort historically to grasp back at the documentation. His hermeneutic method is one of interpreting his experience in light and with historical example of where that experience had repeatedly occurred before him. But his duty was not to become a prophet or magician or artist. He was to understand the experience. He had been given the staff with the serpent, the magical wand. He understood it to be the rod and serpent of the healer, of the father of physicians, of Asclepius. He came to this task to heal, to bring together the forgotten elements. He had been shown that journey, not to become a prophet, but to become a knower. A knower. A knower of the unseen. A knower of the hidden half. A knower of the other pole. A knower of the undiscovered fact of the soul, of the self. This was Jung's journey of individuation. This was his task in life. For 40 years after this event, he served the event. What had happened to him, he honored, he cherished, and he served it. The prophet served. The prophet served a bride. A bride. Thank you very much.